Welcome back. This is the second panel. And we have three distinguished speakers on this panel on religion. But I was just reminded that this is actually not just about, not so much focusing on religion per se, but really more about the interplay between religion and politics. Before we start, I forgot to introduce myself. I'm James Tang. I'm the dean and the professor of political science at the School of Social Sciences at Singapore Management University. Surprise, surprise, former graduate of LSE. And I can see that on this panel, we have, in terms of academic backgrounds, two are affiliated, well, actually we have three affiliated with LSE, we have also Kimama Chi, as well as Kirsten, actually, I think somehow connected to a less significant university somewhere northwest of London. This is also a panel that Kirsten said is obviously different from the earlier panel just by our composition and appearances. I think you can make the conclusion about diversity and all the rest. The other thing I just want to highlight, I think I cannot be standing here at the inaugural Southeast Asia Forum with the center without also acknowledging my former teacher and mentor, Michael Lever, who really had shaped my intellectual development as well as have been very important in my own academic career development. So I think this is also appropriate for me to recognize his contribution and his impact in Southeast Asia. So I'm really grateful to have this opportunity. And then with Professor Saw Swee Hock, really supporting this particular initiative and all the work that Danny did in making this possible. The question about religion and politics is really the key theme. And I think most people would acknowledge that religion is indeed of huge significance in the political and social development in Southeast Asia. And in recent years, I think the international media had been paying more attention to more radical forms of religion and the tragic violence and attacks that took place. But obviously religion has far greater fundamental importance in shaping what had happened in Southeast Asia. I don't think we would be able to cover everything, the rich history and how things have been shaped by religion in our part of the world. But yet I think our panelists today will be able to, I think, address probably not in a unified way, but how there has been the revival, I think, of all sorts of political concerns linked to religion in different forms, both domestically and the international implications of such developments. We'll try to keep to that 50-minute presentations and then open the floor for questions after our rapporteur has a chance to speak. I don't think I need to introduce all our panelists individually. You can read their impressive CVs, and if they want, they could also, I think, do a bit of self-introduction.
First of all, thank you so much for LSE for existence, and Karsten and Jenny working so hard for our partner existence. Thank you. And I'm sure that like, you all feel like very lively. And in my talk, I like to talk about how religion, identity, and minority issues involve, including women and ethnicity. So as we all know that there are nexus between religion and politics. And in Burma, traditionally, there is a reciprocal relationship between the political authorities and monks, Buddhist institution. Since 11th century, when the king Anoyata brought Buddhism to Bagan and make it united Burma as a kingdom, and he actually take his role as a patronate, and he support monastic order and religious activities. In terms, monks have to provide legitimacy of king's political authority and moral education to the communities, and also Buddhist cultural values. So actually, they have a very strong reciprocal relationship in Burma, and monks were playing a solely teacher's role, that schools and monasteries are called chaung, the same word. So actually, this traditional Dhammayaza, Buddhist cosmology of religion and politics and social system collapsed under the colonial rule. And it destroyed a reciprocal relationship between political authority and spiritual power. So, the loss of Tathanabai, which is the head of the monastic order, religious order, was now replaced. Burmese also felt that behind the lack of monastic education, Burmese cultural values were lost. Burmese concerned citizens were debating about Burmese youth were eating beef and consumption alcohol. That became a very big value and are disrespectful to their elders. So that created resentment to the colonial power. So in other words, Burmese respond to foreign encroachment was not even economic power. It is about emotional response of feeling humiliation to their Buddhist culture. Because of traditionally, as I said before, because of Burmese society also enjoying the masculine power, particularly the monks, the men. In Burma, since 11th century, 8 or 9 out of 10 Burmese are Buddhist. So all Burmese family has aimed to send their kid to be novice in the monastic order. And Burmese men also can become a monk any state of their life, as often as they could. As one scholar said that, this is a custom that whenever men face a crisis in his life and their life, even as small as to run away from a nagging wife, he can be a monk. And money was not necessary. And everybody can provide necessary. All you need is monk robes, begging bowl, and shaved head. So, and you can see that Buddhism and Burmese identities are closely intertwined. So, and they are inseparable. So Burmese believe that Buddha is Burmese, such a tribe. So in Burma, unarguably, Buddha is a Burmese. They responded to British colonialism they have been Buddha's race, unlike the one being discriminated and humiliated by the British. who is from Iberics. So, and that's just like one thing that they did. So another, that's the reason that, okay, so like another thing is that they also reinvented porn. Porn is called, Burmese believe that men are born with porn. At the time, they reinvented porn as a racial superiority. So like the Burmese have this racial superiority, British did not have it. So that's like a legitimization of racial superiority of Burmese over the British. So then, Burmese traditional educators of monks and modern new elite Western educated Burmese reinvented tradition of poem. And second, they also established an organization, prominent organization called Doberma. Doberma is like a we Burmese or our Burma. So you can see that this is like a kind of responding to the colonialism is like not just emotion. They also like combine with traditional concept and modern concept. And that is like leading to when Burma got it, independent. And Burmese society is already extreme Burman centric because of Doberma, our Burma, we Burmese, you are un-Burmese. So this concept particularly created different kind of sentiment. Previously, under the colonial rule, British created superiority over Burmese, and they created non-Burmese. So they created the exclusion of non-Burmese. And another nationalist, not only non-Burmese are targeted, but also they targeted un-Burmese. Un-Burmese mean Burmese and do not love enough for the race, religion, and culture. Particularly women who married to non-Burmese were targeted with a traitor and bringing dangerous to the race, the culture. And women are also considered as distrustful because they have a potential to bring danger to Burma. I'll come back to this point later. That leads into the current democracy movement. Under General Nguyen, when Burma got independence, Burma was two-sided. One is like the new nationalist attitude and ideologies, but real outcome of colonial legacy, which created multiple ethnicity, culture, and religions. So that actually, and Burmese forced assimilation of Bogis Burmese as one unit in Burma. That created conflict between the two. So, and it's really interesting that and when General Nguyen took power, his motto was one religion, one language, one ethnicity. And one voice, one blood, one nation. So it's he has a clear policy, forced assimilation or discrimination toward the others because they are dangerous. So Dr. Aung San Suu Kyi has been constantly targeted as others. So it's because of her marriage to the very race of former colonizers. So she is considered as a woman, opposition, and traitors, dangerous to the religion, race, and culture. So xenophobic and negative portrayal of others as distrustful, and dangerous literature come up under military rule. Particularly, Dr. Aung San Suu Kyi has been targeted in the newspaper for 5 years, every single day. She was said that Kalamia, Kala is very discriminated term for Indian origin. But as a kind of also, they also say that this also mainly of Muslim, but white Anglo-Saxons are called Kalapu, white Indian. But particularly, they discriminated Muslim origin of color. So she has been constantly in the newspaper with a lot of cartoons and Kalah Maya, wife of the Kalah, and corporate, former prostitute of Kalah, and puppet, and so and so on. And she is a symbol of women, as in a symbol of evil, and who is dangerous and collaborating with the West to destroy Burma. So like a kind of, there is a, like this kind of xenophobic and creating dangers and fear among the society. And through the education and propaganda, and Burmese start to like an internalized, you know, like an, a difference as dangerous, and not appreciation of difference. But it's a really interesting thing. And now coming back to religion, monks, they know that monks are very important in Burmese society. They are rallying forces. And so actually that they want to get monks to support them, but monks led to the protest. In Burma, protest means tani begging bowl upside down. So that is a protest in Burmese. So you can see the monks' involvement in politics. But monks rejected because they did brutal crackdown to the monks for involving 88 protests. So what they did was, of course, only the way that they know the divide and rule. They actually approached to the senior monks and offer titles, awards, and telling them that that kind of monks they respect, not the other kind of monks. So senior monks supported them, and so they set up religious ministry and civilian registration for the monks' population. And many monks were sentenced to jail. So, and interesting thing is that what happened recently after 2012, the military has a xenophobic attitude and patriarchy values. So a man, very prominent writers in Burma, who was sentenced to 2 years jail because of, he said, Buddha is not a Burmese. He was a member of NLD. What did NLD has to do? Expel him. So because of like, this is like a kind of, this is a sentiment is so strong. So now I'd like to go to the, how much also this impact to another side, women. So actually we studied like a kind of poem. Poem is like kind of considered as a racial superiority and increasingly become a sexual superiority. And they now believe that men are born with poem on their right shoulder. And it's a birthright indicator of spiritual superiority. Women's behaviors can destroy their poem. Not only behavior, but attitude. If they touch this right shoulder of men's poem with their lower part of clothing. So, and then like, you know, so women have to be careful washing, drying, you know, like in a storing, and they cannot put it together. So in Burma, you never find women clothes flying. And if you fly your clothes, if you fly your skirt in Burma, you will be targeted. So, and so like, again, so Dong Aung San Suu Kyi, male members were attacked by the Burmese government in the newspaper that these male members lost their poem because they are under the women. So actually, the really interesting thing, that internalization of patriarchy, masculinity value, is so much so that that led to international movement. It is called Panties Power. So like it kind of in 2008, when the cyclone happened and when Burmese government rejected, you know, like rejected, you know, international community, international women's rights movement, started to do like, I know, and you know, I started with the Panties Power campaign, Power for Peace, right? Like, and they said that you can post and you can read it, you can post and flank and how much ever you want to the Burmese embassy. And Burmese embassy received, I hope no Burmese, no people from Burmese embassy. Also like, again, Burmese embassy received millions of panties. So that was like, you know, considered the most powerful powerful like a kind of campaign that never shake Burmese regime like this one. So actually, the really interesting that actually led to, what about women? What do they have? So the contrast to poll, women values, feminine values are shame and fear. So if you actually bring so shame, fear, and dishonor, you know, like an honor of men are complementary to each other. So actually the women who are shameless, we can define everything shameless, wearing short skirt to like hanging out with a foreign man. And that's like, you know, that led to a national disgrace. And like, you know, so it's like a punishment. And also not only separating good women to bad women, but also bad citizen and good citizen. So actually, the Aung San Suu Kyi is, of course, bad citizen, not just a bad woman. So, and that is the reason the military supported Mabata marriage law. It was started in 2012 for a gang rape of Rakhine women by four Muslim boys. But they started that, like, you know, Burmese women are being lured to marry to, you know, like, you know, Kala, like foreigners, right? And then that led to a proposal of four law, marriage law. Under this marriage law, so it's like, again, under this marriage law, a woman cannot marry, women cannot marry freely or have a baby within three years. They need a permission from the government. If they want to marry a man from none other than Buddhist. So actually that's creating like a reduce. But also like a shame and violence is also linked. So actually that here, a group of men beating a group of women for having boyfriend of Muslim origin. This is in Malaysia. So actually that like they feel that like, and what more is like a kind of reviews from Facebook. Like, again, you know, one of them said that, oh, these men have no other option. They are disciplining for the girls because they want to protect women. So that is like an internalization of this phone shame and all that. So now, just before that, like, and just finally, what I want to talk about, the Rohingya issue. And I have been talking about this. I want to leave to the last minute. So we talk about Rakhine State. 2 days ago, there was a conference in Oxford University, and there's all the, like, you know, Desmond Tutu, Amayata, San Spirit, all the famous big names support. And, there's a lot of calendar, postcard, everything. What happened in 2012 Rakhine State? Rakhine is the second poorest in Burma. Rakhine live with Rohingya and common Muslim. And when conflict happened, both sides suffer. But international one-sided humanitarianism only focused on Rohingya. So that created a lot of sentiment between the Rakhine. What about us? So that is one issue. Now, Khmer Muslims are also showing resentment. So in general, Rakhine are one of the most discriminated ethnic groups in Burma. There is a proverb saying that if you meet a Rakhine and a snake, kill Rakhine. So you can see that the Rakhine feel like in Burma, Burmese society has been discriminated. International community also discriminated. So what happened now? Rakhine has growing like a kind of sentiment that led to Rakhine is the only one party that won, only ethnic party that won the election. Rakhine is the only one party that beat to NLD in Rakhine State. Rakhine is the only one party that now challenging NLD and walking out from the parliament. And Rakhine is the only one party that fighting with arms and producing refugees. So when we talk about now, here is like a kind of, we are talking about, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi has been constantly accused by insider that she is so favored to Muslim. Outside, they accuse her not being cited to Rohingya. So this is a conflict and, you know, contradictory political ideologies and the way you see the humanitarianism, nationalism, you know, like an ethnocentric Buddhism, all will be hindering Burma democracy. So we must remember that under military prolonged rule, Burmese education system is wiped out and we have no critical thinking skill. So we need to, it will take some time to make changes and to build Burma as a democratic society. So actually, like, you know, this is a long-term process and we cannot just like, you know, one side fit all will not work in Burma. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kimama Chi. I think now we have our rapporteur, Judith, who had a challenging task of summarizing this. I'm glad that you are the one doing it now, not me.
So I think that there are two broad points that we need to think about at the end of those very, very interesting speeches. The first of which will be about the fragmentation and weakening of centralized state control in these countries, which thus allows for non-state or sub-state actors to reassert themselves, particularly religious non-state or sub-state actors to reassert themselves. So you see that with the democratization or nascent democratization of Burma, that you see the rise of really fundamentalist Buddhist groups, that with the weakening of control in Malaysia under UMNO, that you also have a reassertion of the religious right or the nationalist right. And finally, in Indonesia, that in the post-Suharto era, you also have a weakening of centralized state control, and thus the rise of fundamentalist Islamic jihadist groups as well.
Just to quickly have a sort of a few takeaway points and then conclude this session very quickly. My first takeaway is really that there are still troubling developments in Southeast Asia as far as religion and politics are concerned. Apart from the radicalization and some of the issues that we've been looking at, we've also seen minority groups being marginalized, and religious nationalism, I think, is still something that's troubling the region. The second sort of point I think is relevant here is how far things have changed and how the state has become less capable in shaping the narratives and even maybe responding effectively to some of these challenges. But I think to sort of put things into a broader regional perspective, I just want to remind the audience that we are really talking about a very diverse region. We're sort of reminded of the Religious Diversity Index, claiming that Asia is leading the world in religious diversity. And our region is home to two of the world's most religious diverse countries, Singapore and Vietnam, and then two of the least diverse countries, Cambodia and Timor-Leste. We've been listening to the presentations, and obviously each of the cases are very different. Moving forward, sort of my final point, how do we think about that in the broader regional context? I'm sort of also thinking about how religion would continuously to be important no matter what narratives are we dealing with. And maybe some figures could be of interest based on the Pew Research surveys. And there were questions on how much political influences should religious leaders have. And respondents in Malaysia, this is a survey of a few years ago, basically 41% said they should have a large influence, and 41% had responded by saying that they should have some influences. So 82% of the population surveyed wanted religious leaders to have influences in political affairs. In Indonesia's case, it's 30 and 45, so a total of 75%. There are no figures on Myanmar. But I would say that at least I find comfort in the other sets of figures, that those who were surveyed on the question of whether the other people should have freedom in the practice of the religion among the Muslim population in Indonesia, 93% actually say that other people should have that freedom. And in Malaysia, it's a bit lower, but still 83%. I think with that, at least I feel that the region moving forward, there's still a population of society that is not closed to other people practicing different religious beliefs. So with that, I want to thank our panelists for their wonderful presentation today.